I call Senate Resources Committee to order. Today is Monday, February 6, 2017. Let the record reflect. The time is 3:30 p.m. Committee members present, Vice Chair Senator Coghill, Senator Meyer, Senator Stedman, Senator Von Imhoff, Senator Hughes. I expect Senator Wilikowski will be joining us shortly, and myself, Senator Giesel. Thank you to Ann, the recording secretary today, and to our LIO staff. Today we have three items on the agenda. First, we're going to hear House Joint Resolution 6, and then we're going to have a presentation by the Department of Environmental Conservation on its primacy responsibilities with respect to federal Clean Water and Clean Water Acts. And last of all, if there's time, we'll get to Senate Bill 3 by Senator Stedman. So on to our first item. For the public, this is the first resolution this committee has heard in the 30th Alaska Legislature. It is a joint resolution related to a road. The people of the Alaskan village of King Cove have been requesting for decades a small one-lane gravel access to an all-weather airport in nearby Cold Bay. For decades, that request has been met with, in the words of our congressional delegation, secretarial antipathy. House Joint Resolution 6 asks the legislature to support efforts by Alaska's congressional delegation to achieve a land exchange authorized by Congress. The federal wilderness area surrounding King Cove would receive approximately 43,000 acres of state land to put in refuge and wilderness status. In return, less than 400 acres for a road corridor would be opened for this access between the settlements of Cold Bay and King Cove. The sponsor of this legislation is the Speaker of the House, Representative Bryce Edgman, and I invite him to come to the table and make remarks about this resolution. Thank you, Speaker Edgman. Welcome.
Thank you, Chair Giesel, committee members. For the record, my name is Bryce Edgman. I represent House District 37, which, as you mentioned, includes the communities of King Cove and Cold Bay. I think I can do this fairly quickly. The resolution basically expresses the legislature's appreciation and support for legislation that Senator Murkowski and Representative Young have introduced, and legislation that would allow for the land exchange necessary to complete what is essentially about a 30-mile road connecting King Cove and Cold Bay. About 18 miles of that road is essentially been constructed, sort of sitting there unused because of the remaining 12 miles that needs to be constructed. This issue, as you pointed out, has been sort of lingering year after year, some 30 years or so. The measure that created the land exchange in 2010 that passed the Alaska legislature passed 60-0. There was no opposition. Most recently, this resolution passed the House 39-0, and so there's been a tremendous amount of support for the road through the Alaska legislature. The bill before you, obviously it's a resolution that doesn't have a fiscal note, and once again we're hoping to get the support of the Senate, and if timing provides, to be able to personally hand this resolution to the Senator when she, Senator and Representative, when they come through Juneau here in a couple of weeks. So with that, once again, thank you for the committee for taking this up as quickly as you have, and would stand by to answer any questions. And I also have my staff here, Madam Chair, if there's technical questions that I can't answer.
Thank you, Speaker Edgman. You may have noticed the large number of senators who have signed on to this joint resolution also. One of the things I appreciated about it is the numerics that you provided, the number of folks that have been affected negatively by the lack of the road. So I appreciated that in your joint resolution. Are there questions for Speaker Edgman? Senator Coghill?
I was going to say it's pretty straightforward. I think we've supported measures like this. I think
we even wrote letters of support privately. So,
Senator Meyer.
Thank you, Madam Chair. Thank you, Speaker. I mean, this is something I think we all support, but I do believe that the state of Alaska is in litigation over this currently. Do you know what the status of that might be?
Madam Chair, can I pull my staff up here and have him just sort of be able to answer that in one fell swoop as opposed to me?
Thank you, Madam Chair. My name is Tim Clark. I'm staff to Representative Edgman. Senator Meyer, through the chair, the state is currently in ongoing litigation with Interior over issues related to the authorization for the land exchange and road that dates from the Public Lands Act of 2009. And I believe there are several dimensions under litigation, one is which whether the authority for the exchange that was created in 2009 and 2010 through the state's reciprocating legislation is still valid. And this resolution was in fact amended slightly to make sure it wasn't treading on any of the concepts under discussion in that legislation, so that it now in its last or penultimate whereas refers to the authorization, refers to the new bills introduced by the D.C. delegation as ensuring the continuing authorization for the exchange in the road.
Follow-up, Senator Meyer?
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Further questions? All right. Seeing none, I'll open this up for public testimony then.
Thank you.
If you'd like to stand by, if you want to make closing remarks after. So in looking here at folks signed up to testify, we'll start here in the LIO. I see a William Dushkins signed up here in the room to testify. If you would like to come forward, please. And that he will be followed by Jennifer Harrison here in the room also. Welcome, Mr. Dushkins. So if you would introduce yourself for the record, and I'm allowing a two-minute testimony.
Yeah,
welcome.
Thank you, Madam Chair and board members. My name is William Dushkin, Sr. Originally reside in Sandpoint. I've lived in King Cove, been around there all, I'm related to everybody there, you know. And I don't understand the politics of this road not being there now, you know. If it saves, it's just one life, you know. The state and the federal government are paid in full, you know. And why is the federal government demanding so much land back from the King Cove Corporation? I mean, it doesn't seem fair. That road's already got close to 100 miles of little road that the military's put on it. It drove over it for years and years, and it didn't hurt anything. And here we're trying to do something good, you know. And like I said, it's going to open the gates to King Cove. We've got one of the biggest processing plants in the world sitting there in King Cove. And just think if that road opened up, you know, the benefit of that, you know, fresh seafood coming out of there, going and leaving, you know. I just don't understand, you know. I can't fathom why it hasn't been done already. You know, that's about all I can say.
Great. Thank you very much, Mr. Dushkins, for your testimony. Let's see. Jennifer Harrison is up next. Welcome, Ms. Harrison, if you'd introduce yourself for the record.
Good afternoon. My name is Jennifer Harrison. I'm the CEO with Eastern Aleutian Tribes. We're the organization that manages the health clinic in King Cove and the health clinic in Cold Bay. And so I first of all just wanted to share my appreciation for the senators that have and representatives that have supported us in the past, and we're hoping that they'll support us this year. And I just really wanted to introduce myself and let you guys know that I was here this week. If you had any questions about this, people, you know, sometimes ask about the 55 emergency evacuations and the 17 Coast Guard, and where do those numbers come from? Those numbers come from me directly. I get them out of our tracking system, and I send them forward. And so if anyone has any questions about those, I'd probably be the best person to ask. And I just wanted to quickly share that I experienced this just this weekend. Just this weekend, I tried to fly out on Friday. I was in King Cove all week. and the plane hadn't flown for 3 days because of a soft runway, not because of bad weather, but because it's a gravel runway. So we could not fly out for days. Finally, I found a fisherman that was willing to take me over to Cold Bay on Saturday, and I got to climb that ladder just like everybody else, and I can tell you that it was pretty scary. It was windy, it was cold, and you have to hang on for your life as you climb up that ladder. And there was an elderly person with me going to a health appointment that had missed her health appointment 3 times, but she didn't want to miss it. She'd missed it twice because of weather. She didn't want to miss it a third time, and so she was willing to go on the boat and climb up that ladder so she wouldn't miss that Panair flight to Anchorage. So that was just me on Saturday. I mean, you've heard all the stories, but I just wanted to share it from someone that actually experienced it, actually saw it. We left at 11 o'clock. Behind us at noon, trying to catch the same Panair flight, was a man that had been in our clinic, and he had to meet a medevac. But medevac wasn't coming to King Cove, so he had to get on a boat half an hour behind me, and they had to speed just trying to get there in time so he could catch a medevac in Cold Bay. And so just in really the last 48 hours, I have 2 stories that I personally witnessed. So I just wanted to share that and let you guys know that I'm here this week if you have any questions about the medical side of these statistics. Thank you.
Thank you very much for your testimony, Ms. Harrison. Next, we'll go to the Ketchikan LIO. Mike, it looks like Sally is there in Ketchikan. Mr. Sally, can you hear us?
Yes, this is Mike Sally.
Welcome. Please identify yourself for the record and give us your testimony.
Yeah, I'm Mike Sally. I was born in Ketchikan. Other than a few short absences to go to school and be in the military, I pretty much, this has been my home base for my whole life. I haven't been listening in on what's been going on with this King Cold King other than hearing little bits and pieces of it. And so I came up, I basically had a question in my mind from the start of this thing. And that question is, what is it about King Cove that apparently justifies so much political effort being expended to grant that community an exception to longstanding environmental protections in order to punch a road across the critical habitat of a national wildlife refuge? And I'm reminded that my mother, who died when she was 71. She lived alone with her chickens, dogs, cats, and parakeets by choice the last 15 years of her life on a semi-remote homestead with only a 14-foot skiff for transport to the Ketchikan road system. She accepted the cost of operating and maintaining that skiff as well as the risks and difficulty dictated by weather and sea conditions. But it was for her a fair trade-off for living in a place she loved. She did not ever demand that her community or her government provide her the means to travel comfortably and safely to a remote home of her own choosing. And it's not unusual for hardy pioneers, when confronting old age and failing health, to leave their beloved remote homes to be closer to adequate health care. There are people scattered all over the state of Alaska, living in remote settings where quick and ready access to medical services simply does not exist. I can think of the Olsons, who live over in Chalmley Sound. They've been living there for decades. The Gallatins live there for a while. There's people living down in Moira Sound. Again, there are people all over the state. So I'm left to presume that the real motivation is to create a precedent of allowing development in wildlife refuges in order to weaken protections for places like the Alaskan Arctic National Wildlife Refuge. Perhaps a side benefit of paying back a native corporation for its electoral support of a Republican candidate.
Mr. Sally, if you could wrap up, please.
Okay. Did anyone in King Cove consider buying or leasing their own helicopter from Medevac to Cove Bay? Or are they going to put a road over to False Pass, for example, 35 miles to the other side of Cove Bay, so that those people can have ready access to Medevac? I'm at a loss to understand why people are so profoundly for this joint resolution.
Thank you for your testimony, Mr. Sally. Next, we will go to the off-net. Henry Mack is calling in from King Cove. He is the mayor, it looks like. Mayor Mack?
Yes, good afternoon, Madam Chair Giesel and members of the Senate Resource Committee. My name is Henry Mack. I am the mayor of the city of King Cove. I want to thank you for this opportunity today to comment on this Bill HJR6. I was born and I lived here in King Cove all my life. I've been a commercial fisherman here for the last 50 years, and I'm currently on my fifth term as the mayor of the city of King Cove. I respectfully request you pass this bill out of the Senate Resource Committee. This land exchange process will finally lead to the approval of a small road corridor from King Cove to Kobe Airport. This process has been a long time in the making. Back in 1976, I was on the city council back then when we first adopted the first resolution identifying the need for a road access to the Kobe Airport. Our 900 residents constantly experience and understand about the weather and topographical impacts on our daily life. This is particularly true for the accessibility to the Kobe Airport, which is our primary connection to the outside world. We have winds in excess of 50 miles an hour on a regular basis. The result is that our small King Cove Airport, precariously perched adjacent to volcanic mountains, is unable for about 30 to 40% of the time for a single engine plane make a scheduled flight in and out of the community. This translates into about 100 days a year when getting in and out of King Cove cannot occur. This land exchange leading to the construction of a 12-mile, one-lane gravel road will change this situation. This road will resolve our transportation access problems so that our residents of King Cove can finally have a safe and dependable access to the Cold Bay Airport. Just to comment on what Jennifer Harrison commented about on the boat ride the other day, on that same boat, there was a mother and a newborn that was out to Anchorage for a checkup, and they were just getting back home. Mom had to take baby and wrap her inside of her coat and security tie her in there and climb down that 20-foot ladder. And very stressful on mom and also dad standing on the boat watching. So those are every weekly things that happen. This last, since February or January 1st until February 6th, we've had probably 14 days due to weather conditions, unable to get into our airports here. So it's pretty much a monthly thing where boats has to be accessed. And being fishermen and stuff, we still don't like to travel when it's nasty with our kids and our family. So this would be a stress relief for all of us if we can get this access in here. We have 17 miles of road on the King Cove side of Cold Bay that is going down toward the head of Cold Bay today, right bordering, the road goes right up to the refuge. There's actually 5 miles of the road access that's built on King Cove side that's in the refuge already today. And we've been driving on for 5 years now. And the effect on the animals and the birds and what have you is pretty much null and void. There's no impact. I mean, the bears are walking with us on the road as we travel it and what have you. So the impact is pretty insignificant. But I want to sincerely appreciate the support of our current legislation, Governor Walker's administration, with working with us to resolve our transportation access problems. Thank you very much, Honorable Senators, for listening to my testimony today. I urge the passing of this HRJ number 6 out of the Senate Resource Committee as soon as possible. Thank you, Matt.
Thank you very much, Mayor Mack. I see that Gary Henai from the city of King Cove is online for questions only. Is that true, Mr. Henai? Questions only?
Yes, Madam Senator, so I'm just available for questions.
All right, thanks very much. I don't see anyone else online wishing to testify. Is there anyone else in the room wishing to testify on House Joint Resolution number 6? Seeing none, I'll close public testimony. With that, Speaker Edgman, did you have further closing remarks? Thank you. So, Senator Coghill, I will look to you for a motion.
I'd like to move the CS for House Joint Resolution Number 6, version Juliet Alpha, I think dated 2-1-17 from committee. It has a attached zero fiscal note.
Thank you. Is there objection to the motion? Seeing none, this joint resolution will move from this committee then. We'll take a brief at ease to sign the documents. Back to order. Our next item on the agenda is hearing from the Department of Environmental Conservation. We have Commissioner Larry Hartig with it, with us, as well as Deputy Commissioner Michelle Hale. Did I get that right?
Director of the Division of Water.
Director. Okay, sorry. Thank you. This department regulates air and water quality under primacy authority of the Clean Air Act and the Clean Water Act. This means the State Department is administering both state and federal requirements. So what we're looking for today is an overview of those duties and identify points of discussion between his agency, DEC, and the federal agencies with which the commissioner has to interact. So welcome, Commissioner Hartig.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Larry Hartig, Commissioner of the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. I certainly appreciate this opportunity today to talk about our primacy programs and interaction with EPA and other federal agencies. There's going to be four topics that I was planning to cover today, but I can certainly adjust however the committee would like me to give an overview of the DEC primacy programs, focusing primarily on the air permitting and the water permitting, since those are most relevant to resource development in the state. I'll touch briefly on regulations. A lot of the regulations we do are driven by federal requirements, and I'll talk a little bit about that and how we weigh that and flexibility we may have there. And then talk a bit about the new federal administration and Congress. And we are anticipating changes. We have no crystal ball, but I'll tell you some of the issues I think that'll be at play and both nationally and here in Alaska and sort of how we're positioning ourselves, if you will. Lastly, I'll give a quick status report on some specific topics, including Tier 3, outstanding natural resource waters. You recall the bill last year. It was heard in this committee, a lot of discussion and public testimony in this committee. I'll talk about the status of that effort to develop a Tier 3 process. And then I'll talk a little bit about kind of going back to federal state permitting, talk about specific the coal industry and some of the issues that I see there today in Alaska and nationally. And with me today is Michelle Hale. She's our director of our water division. And within the water division is our wastewater discharge permitting program. So if we want to dive into any specifics, we can. Oh, there's one other thing I know that we had on the list that you want me to talk about. That's the VITA legislation, Vessel Incidental Discharge Act. So I'll talk a little bit about that. And Michelle is here to help me with that. And also we have Ben White in the audience, and he's our manager of our cruise ship vessel program, and he's been the one that's been tracking that VITA legislation, so he could get into any details that we need from him today. He's also here for SB3 if we get to that.
Great. Thank you.
So the primacy programs, and I'll define primacy in my own words here, but it's a federally required program that can either be delegated or assigned to the state to run. And so most of the programs that are set up under EPA's environmental regulations, they were put together by Congress with the idea the states would actually run it, and that there should be this what we call cooperative federalism between the federal government and the state, where they're equal partners in environmental regulation. That's generally the way it's been set up. And so the two big programs that we have from EPA are the air permitting program, and I'll talk more in detail on that in a minute, and the wastewater discharge permitting program. Nationally, it's called the National Discharge Pollution National Pollution Discharge Elimination System. We changed to be Alaskanized that, so it's the APDS program here. Two other large primacy programs we have is the Public Drinking Water Program, that's in our Environmental Health Division, and pesticides. But I won't be speaking to those today. But we do have other primacy programs besides the two big ones, air and water. So primacy. We've had primacy in the air program going back to essentially the beginning of the time that the Clean Air Act was implemented in the 1970s. It's a very mature program. We've been issuing air permits for 40-plus years. In my own mind, we have one that's equal to any other state in the nation, you know, in terms of its quality and the longevity and the expertise of the staff. On the NPDES side, the APDS side of things, wastewater, we pursued primacy, and we were given primacy by the federal government in 2008, and it was done under a phased approach. So over 4 years, they phased in the transition from EPA writing the wastewater permits and Alaska to Alaska writing those permits. At the time that we got primacy, we were only five states that didn't have primacy. We're the only ones that, in Region 10 now, there's only one state that's left that doesn't have primacy, and that's Idaho, and they're pursuing primacy. So when Idaho gets primacy, and we anticipate they will, there'll be no state in our region of the country, the northwest part of the country, that doesn't have primacy. The benefits that I see to the state in primacy, and I think I can identify these both from DEC perspective but also from industry perspective, because I was pretty heavily involved when I was in the private sector of urging primacy, the state pursued primacy. But one is that at that time, on the water side, going before 2008, there was only one permit writer EPA had in the state of Alaska for the whole state. And so I know my experience was if you needed an NPDES permit that was at all complicated, you end up going down to Seattle and you meet with them there. Chances were that the permit writer had never stepped foot in Alaska, and they would be working on all sorts of other permits. And within Region 10, EPA's work was largely being dictated, their priorities being largely dictated by federal litigation and decisions by federal judges as to what EPA was going to do next. So it was hard getting the level of service that you needed out of EPA. And then also with the lack of understanding of Alaska-specific conditions and the fact that they were reporting to headquarters and not to the people of Alaska or the people like yourself, leaders in Alaska, their discretion was largely exercised in a way to mirror the rest of the country rather than considering Alaska-specific conditions. So this was frustrating to industry, it was frustrating to the state as a whole, and there was a strong interest in pursuing primacy, and that did lead to primacy. We are much more accessible to people in the state. We commonly try to exercise that discretion when we run into a situation that we recognize has certain elements to it that may not work well as we just follow the national model, but we still follow the same federal requirements. On the air side, again, it's hard for me to make that comparison on that side because we've had it for so long, you know, that there is no air permit writer that EPA has in Alaska. They have an air compliance person, so we have nothing to compare it to. In a minute, I'll talk a little bit about some of the performance and how that's improved, but that's another aspect of having primacy, is that besides setting your own priorities and exercising discretion and being available for people to discuss things with you and work things out, we do able also to put a lot of effort into improving the performance and turnaround on permits and keeping permits up to date. And I'll give you some figures on that.
Commissioner, just a brief question here. So this responsibility of primacy, out of that you generate regulations.
Yes.
What percentage would you estimate of the regulations your department puts forth are the result of having primacy over water and wastewater?
Madam Chair, there's I put them in these categories. I'd say that there's ones where we update to be consistent with national standards that we're required to meet. There'd be ones that we would update just to follow the science and updates on the science. But again, that would be underlain by a federal requirement, you know, to periodically assess the science and update it. So in that sense, I think the only areas I can think of on the water side, and I'll turn it, see if Michelle agrees with me, would be really updating our permit fees, you know, where we periodically update those, again, following state statute. But when we update regulations, it's, I think, generally driven by federal law. I can't think of an instance where it wouldn't be related to NPDES.
Yes, Madam Chair. I don't believe we've had any updates to the primacy regulations since 2008 or 2007 when we took that program over. We may have had one or two very small updates just to adhere to federal law. And the other update that the Commissioner mentioned is that we do update our fees periodically.
Thank you.
I might mention that one of the challenges that people were having in Alaska, particularly resource development people, prior to the state getting primacy, is when the permits aren't issued timely. The problem is that they only have a life of 5 years. That's the maximum term of a permit under federal law for NPDES program. And what happens at the end of the 5 years, if it hasn't been renewed, then it gets administratively extended. And that means the person can still discharge, but they have to meet the requirements of that permit. So two things happen. A lot of facilities discharge under what we call general permits, where you issue one permit for similarly situated dischargers. So rather than everybody getting individual permit, if you're same type of facility as the next guy, you both discharge under a general permit. But the situation when you have administrative extended general permit is no new discharges are allowed under federal law. So, like, for instance, in Alaska, when we took primacy, one of the big problems in Alaska was that there were fish processors that wanted to come in and operate, and the fish processors are generally under one or two, three different general permits, and they couldn't get coverage. And so that was a problem for them because they would want to start up, but they couldn't get the discharge permit to do it. The other thing that comes up is that if you're on an administrative extended permit, you can't modify that permit. In other words, like if you were changing something about your discharge or about your facility, you wanted to expand it or you wanted to change your treatment system, replace something and change your discharge, you wouldn't be able to do that because you couldn't get that change in your permit. And so it was really important for us to keep the permits current, and that's one of our big performance factors. And it went from about 35% of permitted facilities having current permits to 85% today since we've had primacy. And so that's one of our, I think, key measures of success. And that's still improving, by the way. So I just talked about that on the water side. On the air side, on air performance measures, there's several different kinds of permits they issue, but just looking at currently, they had 70 new permit applications come in this year and 2016 and issued 83. And so they were able to dig into some of their backlog and get current. What sometimes changes performance on the air side is you can get particularly large projects like a Point Thompson facility comes in that's very complicated and difficult to permit. It has I can't remember if it's 100 or 200 different emission sources within one facility. I mean, it's very complicated. Or you get a permit application such as the Wishbone Hill project that gets controversial and gets reissued and goes through public notice several times. Those got resolved, and still we were able to make headway on the backlog. So in all, we think that we're doing pretty well. One of the other things that we've been doing on the air side, they went through a lean exercise trying to look at ways of simplifying the process last year, and they were able to increase performance on the small, the minor construction discharge permits from by 35% down to 40 days turnaround on average of those permits. And water's going through some lean exercises right now, so we're continuing to look for efficiencies in those programs also. Before I move on to the one the thing I was going to talk about before I skipped here is on funding, because one of the things that I think that is important to understand on the both these primacy programs is the air quality permits. Those are largely fee supported. In our over air quality division budget, it's only about 10.5 million, and of that, 1.7 is UGF. That's for the whole division, not just for the permitting. And 1.4 million of that is the minimum that required under federal law is what we call maintenance of effort in order to have an air program. That's the minimum amount of investment that we have to put into it. So it only leaves 300,000 for other things. So you can see it's largely fee supported by DGF. The other thing on the water side on the APDS program, these are in the governor's proposed budget for fiscal year 17. The overall budget for the water APDS program allocation is for about 4.5 million, and of that, 636.5 is UGF. And so I look at that and say, well, if you were going to give up primacy, you said that these other advantages aren't worth it. We need to save money here. There wouldn't be that much to save. And then on the water side of things, you would lose that performance. But the other thing you would lose, a couple things, is one is there's still a state statute that requires DEC to issue water permits, 4603-100. So we still have to have a state permitting program. And you couldn't get rid of the state permitting program because one of the things we do is we also certify EPA-issued permits and other federal water permits to comply with state requirements. And we do that. That's where you add mixing zones. There's no federal agency has authority to add mixing zones. The states do that. We do it through that program. So you still need a program that would be able to certify those federal permits and add the mixing zones. So I think that if the primacy programs went away, it would be at a cost. And it wouldn't, to the people of Alaska, and it wouldn't save anything in terms of UGF or very much. Okay, now I'm on to regulations. We talked about that a bit already. That one thing I want to mention is that within DEC, we have a standardized, rigorous process for when and how we do regulations. What will happen is a division will come forward to the commissioner's office, and they'll give their justification and an overview of the proposed set of regulations. It might be there's an update in federal law or that we've done a fee study and that shows that a fee should be increased or whatever, or we see some efficiency in our process we want to implement through regulation. Then we would discuss that as a policy, whether this makes sense going forward. Is it something that we want to do? And then if they got the green light, then they would start using our internal resources to develop that. We also would be looking at, is this something that we should have public work groups on? Is it something that we should reach out and engage the public from the beginning on and to develop this in a more collaborative manner? And for instance, like right now, we're what we call the Air Quality Drill Rig Working Group for air quality, where they meet with the people from the North Slope and the companies up there and Cook Inlet, and including NGOs that are part of this, and tribes, and then discuss ways of simplifying these mobile drilling rigs, because they present different issues for air quality, you can imagine, as they move around. And so that's a collaborative effort. We also have one on fish consumption and human health values. We've done it on anti-degradation before, and we are doing it through work groups with petroleum cleanup levels now.
Sir, Chair. Senator Coghill had a question.
Just on that. So you keep the regulation is based both in our statute and the federal requirements, but these working groups also create their own, kind of regulation weather pattern. I think one of the concerns that I've heard from some of my constituents is that it actually overreaches what you would generally think the federal government requires. Is that because of the different groups that you have coming in to be a part of the regulation packaging?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, it isn't negotiated rulemaking. We're not doing that. So this group would just be advising us. We still hold the pen, and we would decide that we wouldn't. And when we do a regulation, you say we go through a pretty prescriptive process. Among things that we do is we have an internal economist that does a review of the economics of different options, and that would be part of the report, too, that I would get. It would go through Department of Law review to make sure both process and substantive were within the court of the law. So I don't see the opportunity for some outside group to be able to do more than provide their advice to us.
Follow-up, Senator Coghill.
The other thing, I don't know if it's in the exact permits that we're talking about at this point, but and pushback from constituents that they feel that the stringency with which you apply is greater than what they feel that the federal would apply. Is it because of taking unique Alaska aspects into account?
Senator Coghill, through the chair, I'd have to have the specifics, but happy to follow up with you on that because I'm not aware of instance. I know that sometimes there's a misunderstanding of the regulated public of where a regulation might be coming from, and it could appear that way to them, but I'd certainly be happy to take a look at that.
I'll get some specifics, Madam Chair, only because I have some people, it breaks their back economically, and so I'll try to get those specific written up so that they're intelligible for you. Thank you.
Moving on to the new federal administration, of course, we have new president, and we don't have the appointees yet. Scott Pruitt has been the nominee for EPA administrator and has gone through the process back in Washington, D.C. And in the questions that he was getting I did see that he was expressing a lot of support for cooperative federalism, and coming from a state and from a state that was contesting a lot of the new rules and initiatives from EPA, I expect that he would be more likely to look to the states to have more discretion and more say in development of new EPA requirements. So we're hopeful in that way. Also, I sit on the executive committee for the 50 states, their environmental department heads for the 50 states. And I know that when we were working with the congressional committee to put together the questions for Mr. Pruitt, that was the top of our list. You know, is there going to be more emphasis on this cooperative federalism and working with states rather than just telling the states the way it needs to be done. So we're hopeful things will go that way. I mean, that's what I think, and what I think is, when I say the states are doing this, I think it's from both sides of the equation, those states that are more inclined towards resource development and those that are not. It's just that with the last federal administration, there was a lot of feeling that no matter which side of that line you were on, you were still being overly regulated. There's a lot of interest in going back to the states having more control. There are many times when we see that something will come out of Washington, D.C. that won't work well in Alaska. And so we will typically, as DEC, will try to comment on a proposed rulemaking, working with the governor's office, working with potentially affected people in Alaska, see what kind of testimony they're going to submit. So we can go back in time and look at, well, what are the things that we've been working on and commenting on as a state that we think should be taken up in another next administration? And we have been sharing that kind of information, being asked for it. So we are looking at opportunities like that, but I think just having being able to exercise the discretion that was intended under these federal laws, these primacy laws, is where I started from, would be a great benefit, to Alaska.
So, Commissioner, just to follow up on that thread, so if the federal government withdrew some of these regulations, your department would be amenable to pulling back some of the state's regulations as well?
Well, Madam Chair, we'd have to see what they are. I mean, I think when you say pull them back, I'd have to make sure there's not an underlying state requirement. But certainly if there's a lot of what we do in terms of regulation is driven by the federal law. So if that federal law went away, then the question would be simply to the DEC, well, do we have a state mandate to do this? And if we don't have a state mandate to do it, then we don't have any authority to do it. I mean, it
would. Thank you.
Yeah. Okay, so we talked about some of the recent federal rules that have come up that we could get revisited. A big one would be Waters of the U.S. That's the definition of Waters of the U.S. that's used for determining Clean Water Act jurisdiction, both for the wastewater discharge permitting program, but also the dredge and fill program under Section 404 of the Clean Water Act. The Clean Power Plan. That's regulating greenhouse gas emissions from public power plants. As you may know, Alaska got deferred from that rule because of a lot of the differences in the way our systems are built up here and what we could and couldn't do to meet the requirements of the rule. That's in litigation, so we'll see what the next administration does with that. Stream protection rule, Congress just overruled that by a majority. They were acting, I think, on the House side. I don't know if they acted on the Senate side yet to overturn BLM's methane rules. One of the other things that there's a lot of interest in Alaska right now is the CERCLA 108B financial assurances for mines. As you may know, Alaska has its own rules for financial assurances for treating wastewater and maintaining wastewater systems, including after closure of a mine. And so the EPA has proposed a set of rules under CERCLA, which is the federal Superfund statute, that are much more onerous. And the question is should this be left for state jurisdiction or not? And we're not quite sure where that one's going to go at a new administration. But these are some examples of some very Alaska-specific environmental rules that we think will come up. One of the things that we looked at several years ago in terms of primacy is whether the state should take primacy of the 404, that's the dredge and fill program. We have it of the 402 wastewater discharge, but we don't have 404. And there's only, I think, two states have taken primacy. And the reason is because you don't get much when you do get primacy. Even though if you look at the Clean Water Act and the way it's written, Congress intended for states to get primacy of 404. The way it's been interpreted over the years, particularly by the Corps of Engineers, and apparently is still interpreted today, they have to keep jurisdiction over most of the waters, and very little is actually turned over to the states. And so what's turned over to the states doesn't really make it worth running the programs when it comes down to it. And so when we were looking at this question, when we were discussing whether Alaska should pursue primacy, there was a lot of discussion over what are the assumable waters, the waters the state could assume. And in other states having the same issue, eventually they pushed EPA and the Corps of Engineers to form a federal advisory committee to look at this issue and make recommendations on changes because so few states were pursuing it. And Michelle Hale here has sat on that committee. I think they just had their last meeting just last week, I think it was, back in Washington, D.C. So their report will be issued soon. It'll have good recommendations, I assume, that'll be on how to incentivize states or make it easier for states to get primacy. But our understanding is the Corps of Engineers will take a position, no, we don't think legally that states can get much under this program. So that's another thing that we're hopeful that a new Congress, a new administration will be able to address. Although it may not be in a position right now for Alaska to pursue 404 primacy because of fiscal reasons, I think that we still, with 60% of the country's wetlands and all the issues around mitigation in this state and the flexibility we might get if we had that program on how to run, particularly the mitigation banks and so forth, I think it's something we should continue to look at when we have that opportunity. Going down to next topic was Vessel Incidental Discharge Act. There's similar legislation has been introduced in Congress, I think, going back maybe 10 years or so. There's a new bill, Senate Bill 168, and it would do two primary things. It would first regulate ballast water discharge. It would have a national approach to how that's going to be done from larger vessels is what it would apply to for the ballast water. It would be run by the Coast Guard. It would be based on best management plans and practices. It would also preempt the states from regulating that area. The second thing it would do is would regulate incidental discharges, which is a defined term under the Act. It includes about 35 different waste streams. It would also rely on the Coast Guard and BMPs and also preempt states. It also includes exemptions for smaller fishing vessels and fish processing vessels. So those are the basic things it does. We've looked at this and commented in the past on it, and it has good pieces and it has things that we are concerned about in it. Some of the good parts are is that it would be good for the small fishing vessels in Alaska to continue to be able to exempt from the EPA requirements for a general permit for discharges. And it would be good to have oversight of ballast water. But the concerns are, is would the Coast Guard be able to effectively manage this? And where invasive species are a huge concern to our fishing industry and others in Alaska, we can't afford it not to be managed right. And so for the state to give up its ability to be able to go in there and regulate if we see gaps, it may not be safe. You know, and so we'd want to have more assurance on that. And similarly with the incidental discharges, what that would mean is we couldn't regulate gray water. You know, there's black water, which is the sewage, gray water, the other things. And so there's questions whether we'd be able to regulate gray water mixed with black water. And it would certainly have a big effect on our cruise ship permitting program, whether we would be able to continue to maintain that program if FETA passed. It would also then preclude us from perhaps looking at other waste streams that we don't regulate now, but we might want to. For instance, as some ships are installing new systems to deal with air emissions and to prove their air emissions, they put scrubbers on, and that can generate other wastewater waste streams that would need to be managed, and then we'd be precluded from doing that. And so having a national program where the Coast Guard hasn't had the history in this area, this particular kind of work, you know, we're not saying they couldn't do it, but we'd sure want to have more assurances before we'd sign off on it. But on the other hand, there's good pieces, good parts of the legislation, too, but it needs to be watched.
So just for committee members, there is a briefing paper about VETA in your packet, and also the next subject he'll be talking about, which is the Tier 3 water. So there's two briefing papers. Senator Stedman, a question.
Yeah, thank you, Madam Chairman. I'm just kind of curious on this subject matter. The current, dressing of fish and incidental discharge of red water off the decks of the fishing boats is a big issue in coastal Alaska. So if this bill doesn't pass, it gives them a permanent exemption. This is Senate Bill 168. Are we still faced with the potential that at some point they won't give us a waiver on that, and they'll come and try to enforce that? Or how do we go forward, Madam Chairman, to try to protect our industry? And should we get involved in helping steer this Senate bill so it doesn't impact our fisheries and other industries in Alaska?
Senator Stebbin, through the chair, that's one of the many discharges and one of the many types of vessels that could be covered under VETA. There's a lot in there, so I think that, like I say, there's things in there Alaska would really want, and there's things in Alaska that could concern Alaska. The smaller vessels aren't the big item in our mind. It's the larger vessels. And to have a broad, more pragmatic way of dealing with the discharges from the smaller vessels that have less capacity to deal with those waste streams, and they have waste streams that have less concern, makes sense. So there should be exemptions. There should be areas where you do manage by best management practices, and there should be areas where you're more stringent and have water quality standards or other performance-based standards as protective.
Follow-up, Senator Stedman?
I guess I hear what the commissioner's saying, but it just seems like we have a lot of potential risk in the fishing industry that if this bill doesn't pass and the federal government decides we're not going to allow the halibut boats to discharge, deck water, which if anybody's ever seen a halibut fishing trip, it's a bloody bloodbath on the deck when you're dressing 5,000 pounds of halibut in a day. And there's a little bit of red water running around. And it's impossible for them to ever meet it. larger longliners and smaller longliners. So I'm just kind of curious, you know, your feeling on how we can protect ourselves from these good intention bills that really are devastating to some of our industries.
Yeah, Senator Stedman, again to the chair, BETA has a whole range of vessels in there, and I don't think that the part that you're concerned about, the exemption of the fishing vessels, is the part that I see as controversial. I haven't heard any pushback on that exemption, that part. It's on the larger vessels and other waste streams. I haven't heard concerns expressed about the waste stream you're talking about. So I'll talk about Tier 3 if we have a little more time here. I'll just give a quick status report. You'll saw a dear stakeholder letter in your package that went out today, which went out today, and it was sent out to those people that have expressed an interest in the past on Tier 3 waters. And Tier 3 waters are outstanding natural resource waters. It's a defined term out of the Clean Water Act. Each state is required to have an anti-degradation policy. It talks about under what circumstances we would allow degradation of a water of our state. You know, would we allow a discharge of pollutants into the water? And as part of your anti-degradation policy, you have to have a way of designating Tier 3 waters. And Tier 3 waters are the waters that are preserved whatever status they have at the time, good or bad. So if you have a typical example would be if you had a hot water spring, it may not be any good for drinking. It might not be any good for fishing, but you're going to protect it anyway because it has therapeutic or other values. And you're going to preserve it in that state. You're not going to allow any other contamination of it. Similarly, you may have a really high-valued recreational stream. Maybe it's in a national park, and you want to keep it in that exact status. So you're not going to allow any pollution into that water, even if that pollution wouldn't affect aquatic life. It's just that you don't want any pollution. So they're the highest protection. And so it becomes more of a policy call because the next level down, Tier 2, protects all uses like aquatic life, drinking water, and all these things. The water is protected at Tier 2. Tier 3 is preservation. And so that becomes more of a like a designating a park or some other kind of policy decision. And so anyway, Alaska doesn't have a process for designating Tier 3, so we looked at a bill last year. There was a lot of concern raised and a lot of discussion, more discussion than it had to happen. And so there's no bill. This administration is not working on any Tier 3 bill at this time. We don't have a draft of one. But what we are doing is reaching out to the public and getting their ideas on different options and trying to build more of an understanding of what Tier 3 is and maybe try to form more of a consensus. But at least a better understanding of it with the idea that we would come back or somebody would come back with either regulations or statutes and propose a Tier 3 process for Alaska, but not at this time. We're in that outreach. And so in March, we're going to have four workshops around the state. We're going to have one in Juneau. We're going to have one in Anchorage, one in Dillingham, and one in Fairbanks. And I suppose if there's more that are needed, we could do that. We'll see where it takes us. We plan to have a good discussion. We'll do a lunch and learn. I think it's March 7th here for the legislature. It's scheduled to kind of review Tier 3 and update people on it and people that may not have been here last year and heard it. But we're not planning on a bill at this point, this session.
Madam Chair, if I could make one small correction. We will be having Juneau, Anchorage.
Identify yourself quickly.
Yes, I'm sorry. Thank you. Michelle Hale, Director of the Division of Water at DEC. Rather than having a meeting in Dillingham, we're going to do a teleconference and then reach out to Dillingham later for a meeting in person. So we'll be doing a statewide teleconference so that we can be sure and capture all the other communities that aren't able to come to Juneau, Anchorage, or Fairbanks.
Okay.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you, Director Hale.
Okay.
All right.
Last item is on coal-related issues. Coal has been, particularly with all the interest in the on greenhouse gas emissions and climate change, and the fact that coal is a relatively higher carbon fuel source, there's been a lot of environmental interest in coal. And it came up in the Clean Power Plan that I mentioned earlier. One of the biggest sources of greenhouse gases in the country as a whole are these big public power plants, and particularly the coal fire plants. And so the Clean Power Plan nationally was really targeted for those big, large coal-fired plants. If you looked at in Alaska at the plants that would be regulated under the Clean Power Plan in Alaska, it was only about 5 to 6% of our greenhouse gas emissions, as opposed to like close to 50% nationally. So that's one reason that Alaska was deferred from the Clean Power Plan, is we just don't have those big coal-fired greenhouse gas sources in the state. We were deferred, and so now with the new administration, I don't know that that's going to really affect the few coal power plants that we have in the state. We do have some coal fire plants up in the interior, and one of the big problems right now we have in Fairbanks is the fine particulate matter from wood smoke, but there's also some from coal, and there's also what we call PM2.5 precursors, chemicals that end up forming PM2.5 in the atmosphere later. And those can be generated through these power plants. And so when Fairbanks is going to be moved to what we call serious non-attainment this spring by EPA, which means they have to have more rigorous controls on PM2.5 and the precursors, which will require us to go into these power plants, including the coal fire plants, and do a technology review on how they're controlling the PM2.5 emissions, and may result in them having to add additional controls just because of the PM2.5. So that may be coming. Looking at the different coal projects and infrastructure around the state, the Healy Mine, as you know, is operating, and I think they're current on their air permits. On the water permit, I think we're working on a site-specific criterion up there. Or the renewal.
Yes.
The renewal of their permit. They have an existing permit working on the renewal. Wishbone Hill, that's held up on a federal permit that DNR has primacy of, the surface mine coal permit. They have a current air permit that was issued, and it went through an appeal administratively, but it didn't get appealed to the court, so that's final. The water permit, again, that's administrative extended, and I think we're waiting on some more water quality data for that to renew that permit. The Chewitna project and Jumbo Dome, those are proposed projects. On those, I think both of those have site-specific criterion that we're working on.
That is correct, Commissioner.
And what a site-specific criterion is if we have water quality standards limiting the amounts of pollutant that can be discharged to protect different uses of the water, and those are set at a statewide number. And then if you get into individual projects or water bodies, it may justify either a higher number or a lower number based on site-specific conditions. And so that's what that site-specific criteria are. They have to be identified and developed before we can issue the permit. So those are both underway there. Seward Coal Terminal, they were originally covered under a general permit, and then EPA decided that, no, that general permit didn't apply, and there was it ended up being litigation that was brought by an outside group, and it was successful. The Ninth Circuit said, no, they're not covered by the general permit, and so the state went in and did an individual permit that covers them now. I don't think there's any activity right now from the terminal, but they do have their permit they need from us. There's no air permit that's needed. We already talked about the interior power plants. So that's my report.
Thank you very much, Commissioner. Questions for the Commissioner? Or the director? Seeing none. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
So our last item on the agenda today is Senate Bill number 3 by Senator Stedman. So we last heard this bill on February 1st. The bill proposes to extend the exemption and alternative management programs for certain classes of marine vessels as it relates to discharge requirements, and also exempt the new Alaska ferries from the 1% for art requirement. So the committee members submitted several questions to DEC, and the department has provided a response, which should be in your packet. And actually, could I have, well, Director Hale, would you be the person? You actually were the signatory on the letter, if you would come forward. And let's see if committee members have any follow-up questions from your responses. So, committee members, any follow-up for Director Hale at this time? All right. Seeing none, thank you. I'm sure you'll be remaining in the room. I am going to take public comment now, so we may call you back. Thanks very much, Director Hale. So at this time, I'm going to open public testimony for committee members. We've got some folks online for questions. Kessler Woodward from the Alaska State Council on the Arts is online in Fairbanks. Andrea Noble Pellant, also from the Alaska State Council on the Arts, is in Eagle River, available for questions. Department of Law is in the room, as well as Captain Michael Neusel, DOT Public Facilities, here in the room. I'm going to take a brief at ease for 1 second. So right now, a letter is being distributed. It is from the Alaska State Council on the Arts, and it is supporting, the first paragraph says, does not oppose Senate Bill 3 as a one-time targeted exemption from the Alaska Percent for Arts program. So that is informational for committee members. If they would like to speak to the council on the arts, we have two folks online who would certainly be willing to speak to their letter, I'm sure. Are there any questions from committee members about this? Seeing none, is there anyone here in the room who wishes to testify on Senate Bill 3? Is there anyone else online? No one else online wishing to testify either. So at this time, I'm going to close public testimony. Questions from committee members. Yeah. Senator Wilikowski.
Question for Department of Law.
Department of Law, if you could come forward. Welcome. If you could identify yourself for the record.
Chris Pelosa, Department of Law.
Welcome. Senator Wilikowski.
Thank you. Is there any issue with the single subject rule of the Constitution with the way this bill is put together?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, I believe there may be a single subject rule issue with this bill. The Alaska Constitution, Article 2, Section 13, says that all bills have to have a single subject. And while the courts tend to view that very broadly, this bill seems to have two different subjects. One subject is the wastewater treatment from ships, and the second one is this 1% for art. I believe two of the three ships that are covered by the 1% sections of this bill are not even covered by the wastewater sections of the bill because they don't fit under the standards for getting that exemption. So the best I can say is that both the two sides of this bill are related to boats. That's a pretty tenuous connection. So, I can't, as I said, the courts will consider it very broadly, but this bill may be too broad.
Senator Wilikowski.
What would be the consequence if the court decided this was a violation of the single subject rule? Would it strike down both aspects of the bill?
Senator Wilikowski, through the chair, if the court were to find this a violation of the single subject rule, it would strike down the entire bill.
Thank you. Senator Stedman, as the sponsor of the bill, do you have comment?
It might be. That was the operative words. It might not be. It might be challenged. It might not be. I think there's different legal opinions on this subject matter. So it doesn't really concern me personally. And I think
the bill should go forward, and this could be sorted out. This is the first committee of referral. It's got a long ways to go. So it doesn't alarm me. I've seen there are various opinions either way.
Thank you. Further questions on the bill? We have departments present in the room. We also have the Council on the Arts. All right. Seeing none, any further comments, Senator Stedman, from the as the bill sponsor?
No, Madam Chairman. I have no further comments. Just look to the will of the committee.
Thank you. So looking to the will of the committee, Senator Coghill, you have a motion?
Madam Chair, I move that we move the Senate Bill Number 3 from committee version J, Juliet, with individual recommendations, the attached fiscal note.
Is there objection?
No, just I'll object just to make a statement, and then
Senator
I'll withdraw my objection.
You may speak to your objection.
I didn't know what the department would answer when I asked that question, but it does seem like it's an issue. It certainly is an issue. It seems to me that if you pass the bill and someone challenges it, which is, I guess, likely, the whole bill is struck down. It just seems like it might be better to break it down in two different bills, Madam Chair. You are potentially exposing all these small vessels to legal exposure if the bill is struck down. It just seems the prudent thing to do would be to separate it out into two separate bills, Madam Chair. But I'll withdraw my objection, and hopefully a later committee can deal with that those issues.
Thank you, Senator Wilkowski. I appreciate your comments. So with no further objections, Senate Bill 3 will move from this committee. We will sign those documents before we leave the room. This will conclude our agenda for today. Our next meeting will be Wednesday, February 8th. At that time, we will take up an overview of mapping programs being conducted by our State Departments of Transportation and Public Utilities, as well as Department of Natural Resources, in conjunction with the U.S. Geologic Survey. We'll also take up Senate Bill 6 from Senator Hughes regarding industrial hemp. So at this time, the meeting will stand adjourned. The record reflect the time is 4:42 p.m. Please sign the documents before you leave. Thank you.